It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we're going to the King of Markets, the Pike Place Market in Seattle. Now, this one's worth planning a trip around. Our guide is award-winning chef Tom Douglas, who knows Pike Place down to the last salmon and marionberry. Our road food duo, Jane and Michael Stern, are in the California desert chowing down with dinosaurs. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson has some great bargain whites from French chateaus that get no respect. We hear Calvin Trillin's own unique take on eating Japanese. Then we answer that vexing question, what is in those ready-to-eat salad bags? All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. I think it's time to revisit a chronicle I did a while ago about getting three meals from one takeout roast chicken. Takeout roast chicken is everywhere today. Some places are even offering a choice of free-range birds raised without antibiotics or hormones. Those are the ones to go for. Here's how to get three easy meals out of one takeout chicken. Now remember, these are ideas. Vary them according to what you like to eat and what you have on hand. Figure one whole roast chicken per person. Now remember, this is going to be for three nights. The first night, buy your bird on the way home from work. Pick up some of those pre-washed salad greens too, and some potatoes for baking. Tonight you'll have the hot chicken as part of a classic roast chicken dinner. Bake the potato in the microwave. Pick your favorite part of the chicken and keep it warm in the oven. Refrigerate the rest of the bird. To sit down and eat, dress the salad. I use olive oil, wine vinegar, fresh basil, a little minced garlic, and a handful of sunflower seeds for crunch. Flavor your baked potato with balsamic vinegar instead of butter. Set out your chicken and you've got a great dinner. For the second night, let's do a spicy Asian stir-fry that's really quick. You'll need to have on hand some Asian greens like napa cabbage or bok choy, some sweet peppers, fresh ginger and garlic, and peanuts. I always keep hot sauce around for this kind of dish, too. The trick to serving leftover chicken in cooked dishes without drying it out is to add it at the last minute. Heat a little oil in a big skillet or wok. Stir in lots of minced garlic and ginger. When you can smell them, add the chopped up vegetables, salt, and pepper. Stir fry everything over high heat for about 3 minutes. Sprinkle with the hot sauce and maybe a little soy sauce. Add the chicken and a handful of the peanuts. Cook another minute and serve it up. Just to gild the lily, you could make another dish of leftovers of your leftovers. The stir fry is great in a rice salad. Now, speaking of rice, here's my idea for night number three. If you're in the mood for some great comfort food, how about a rice pilaf made with the rest of your roast chicken? You could even make some stock from the bones. Now, here's how you would do the stock. Chop up the bones, put them in a saucepan, add any scraps of meat and bits of chicken skin that you might have handy, then add celery, carrot, and onion, a couple of cloves of crushed garlic, and a bay leaf. Cover everything with water. Simmer it about 3 hours. Strain the stock, cool it down, and chill it. Any fat's going to harden on top of the stock so you can lift it all off, and then you've got chicken stock. Okay, so you don't want to make a production number out of this. The idea of this chronicle is to save you time. So yes, you can use canned chicken broth if you want to. But please do me a favor, freeze the bones. You know, that way you'll have them around if you're ever inspired. I know I'm being a fanatic, but chicken stock's great stuff. All right, here's how to do that basic rice pilaf. You saute onion with your favorite seasonings and some vegetables in a saucepan. Now, it could be onions with basil and garlic and tomatoes, or it could be onion with an Indian curry blend. The idea is you're going to build a flavor base this way. Once the onion is soft, stir in the rice. Here's the formula for how much rice you need. Figure 1/2 cup of uncooked rice per main dish portion. Saute the rice until you can see little white dots in the center of the kernels. Then add the broth. You figure 1 cup of broth for every half cup of rice. In so many words, 1 part rice to 2 parts liquid. Then what you're going to do is add any skin you've got left over from the chicken, because this gives a lot of extra flavor to the pilaf. Cover the pot and let it cook over low heat for about 25 minutes or until the rice is tender. Gently fold in the rest of your roast chicken meat, and if you want to, you could add some frozen tiny peas. They'll cook in the heat of the rice. One trick I like is to take a handful of those organic salad green mixes and stir that into the pilaf. They wilt and they taste great. So, buy one roast chicken, turn it into 3 different suppers, and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, where you'll find the Bialetti Vogue cookware line from Italy, featuring Teflon platinum interiors, polished aluminum bottoms, and stainless steel handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and is distributed by PRI Public Radio International. Well, today, a top chef takes us on a private tour of one of America's extraordinary markets, the Pike Place Market in Seattle. Talk about worth a journey. Food lovers schedule trips to Seattle just to hang out at Pike Place for a couple of days. Our guide is the city's award-winning restaurateur, a chef who has been having a love affair with Pike Place for 25 years, Tom Douglas. Our favorite wine maverick, Joshua Wesson, reports on some great cheap white wines from France. Journalist Calvin Trillin has advice on eating in Japan. Then we talk with the farmer who first came up with the idea of putting ready-to-eat salad in a plastic bag. And as we do every week in the second half of the show, we'll be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So we will roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane and Michael, what's up?
Well, we're in California inside a life-size brontosaurus.
Wait a minute. Hold it up. You don't sound the way you normally sound.
Well, because we're in a life-size brontosaurus.
What are you doing in a life-size brontosaurus?
Usually
pray
when
tell.
We're talking to you, Lynn, we're not inside a dinosaur.
We've been eaten.
Look, I'm sorry. Is this the case like Jonah the whale?
Well,
you got swallowed
kind of
while you were on the road?
It is analogous to Jonah and the whale, except we're going to be coming out the dinosaur, too. Where we are, in fact, is a restaurant called the Wheel Inn in Cabazon, California, right by the side of the highway. You can't miss this place because looming over it, and I mean looming over it, is a life-size brontosaurus and a life-size Tyrannosaurus Rex.
And a life-size version is very, very large. Even in this flat, kind of empty, high desert landscape that the truck stop restaurant is in, you see this brontosaurus and tyrannosaurus for hundreds of feet in every direction before you get there. And it has a great full-service kind of heavy truck driver-style gear jammer menu with, you know, all sorts of chili and steak and hearty breakfasts and home fries and burritos and huevos rancheros. But the greatest thing about it is that for some odd reason, next to this truck stop near Palm Desert, California, are these gigantic dinosaurs that you can walk into and buy souvenirs.
Well, you can't walk into the Tyrannosaurus Rex. Only the Brontosaurus open to the public.
I see. The other one is what, a private dining room?
A private club.
I understand. I see. Yes, I see. So is the food good?
Well, that's the really amazing thing. The food is very, very good. The people that run this place, the man who runs it is... was trained to cook in Czechoslovakia, of all places, and he's really a fabulous cook. His name is Mr. Kathera, and his wife, Marie, is the hostess, And it's so weird to walk into this truck stop, because that is what it is, and Marie is waiting there in a beautiful kind of black dress. She takes you to your table, gives you the gigantic menu, and you order what turns out to be spectacularly good food, in particular, the pies. This place is known for approximately a dozen different kinds of pie, from banana cream to fresh strawberry, and it's really good pie. I mean, and I don't mean good pie for a truck stop. I mean really good pie for any place.
But the gestalt of the whole place is so strange. I mean, as Michael said, that Marie, the owner's wife and hostess, is a very elegant woman wearing a black cocktail dress. You're in this, you know, weird truck stop in the middle of the California desert, and there are these huge brontosauruses and tyrannosauruses outside. So it's kind of like, you know, really kind of a nutty jigsaw puzzle of good food, prehistoric life, and cocktail service.
But did they put up the dinosaurs?
No, in fact, this place has been there and open round the clock since 1964. They bought the place in 1992. I suspect that before they bought the place, it was just kind of standard truck stop fare. And what they've done is to keep the trucker clientele, and they have huge breakfast to please them. But they've also added a certain je ne sais quoi to the menu that really makes it a worthwhile place to eat.
Je ne sais dinosaur.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to look for the dinosaurs near Palm Desert, California, and the lady wearing the black cocktail dress, and it's a truck stop. Okay, we'll
go.
You
can't miss it.
All right. Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Aside from eating with the dinosaurs, Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Square Meals, America's favorite comfort food cookbook. You can get their recipe for a classic truck stop dish, Highway Patrol succotash, and their food finds on our website. That's splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is what you'd call a wine maverick. He's a classically trained sommelier who took a serendipitous turn a while back. Joshua dumped all the esoterica. His mantra is, wine should be a no-fuss, everyday beverage with prices to match. Joshua, welcome back.
How are you?
I'm fine, but what have you been up to?
I've been thinking about what I'm going to be drinking now that the cruel hand of winter has slipped from my neck and things are getting warm in New York. And of course, my thoughts turn to white wine and modestly priced white wine because you know I'm a cheap date.
One of the things I've always liked about you.
And, you know, there are a couple of unsung heroes from France. Muscadet from the Loire.
Right.
Pinot Blanc from Alsace. And Entre Deux Mers, one of the most poetically named wine regions. It's a sub-region of Bordeaux, way down in the southwestern corner of France.
Now, what does it mean?
Entre Deux Mers, it means between the two seas, which is really a misnomer because it's landlocked, this place, Entre Deux Mers, and it's between two rivers, the Garonne and the Dordogne. But we'll let the French have their poetic license because they think they invented poetry anyway.
Mm-hmm. And also it helps sell wine.
Yeah, it does.
So tell me about the wines.
Well, let's start with Entre Deux Mers since we're down in the south. We'll work our way north.
Okay.
You know, a lot of people think of Bordeaux as being a red wine region, and it is well known for its red wines, especially its famous wines like Chateau Petrus and Mouton Rothschild and Chateau Lafite and Margaux. But there's a lot of really delicious, easy-drinking white wine that's made from a trio of grapes, Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, and Muscadel. And these grapes go into white wines, whether they're labeled Bordeaux Blanc or Grave or whatever, and they make delicious, minerally, sort of stony, steely wines that are really easy to drink because they don't rely on wood to get their character. They've got this trio of grapes going in there. And the sun ripens them up nicely because it's down in southwestern France, so they don't have to worry about hail and cold and other things. And Entre Deux Mers is this this landlocked region. It's very beautiful. It's very green and lush. In fact, it looks a little bit like Ireland, but with wine, if you can imagine such a thing. And the bottles never sell for more than $10. And there are lots of different producers who make wonderful Montre de Mer. So I'm not even going to talk about specific producers. Just look for this stuff. They're fantastic because they don't get to see the inside of barrels very often. They're fantastic with a wide range of foods.
That sounds great. Okay, now let's go a little bit north. You said we're going to go from south to north. So what's next?
Let's go to Alsace because, you know, Alsace never gets the credit it deserves. It's one of the most consistent regions in France for making excellent wine. And Pinot Blanc is the workhorse grape in Alsace. It is a grape that that produces an ocean of delicious, easy-drinking wine. Because it's not dissimilar to Chardonnay in terms of its body and weight, you could look at it as a poor man Chardonnay, which for us, given our relative poverty, would be a good thing.
Hear, hear. I like this. Okay.
You know, Pinot Blanc is, it's called Weißburgunder over on the other side of the border. The Germans actually worship it more than the Alsatians do. If you go to an Alsatian winemaker's house and you sit down and you start, talking about grapes and vines and vineyards and life, he'll pull out a bottle or she'll pull out a bottle of Pinot Blanc. That's sort of the house wine of Alsace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it never fails to deliver the goods. It's like Chardonnay without the wood. It's got richness. It's got flavor. It's got aromatics. I'm so in love with this wine. It's the wine that I tell people, if you know nothing about wine, and you go into a wine store, you know nothing about wine, you're in a restaurant, you want to get a great bottle of white, go to the section marked Alsace, grab a bottle of Pinot Blanc, make sure that it's 3 years old or younger, no more than 3 years old, and you're going to have a great experience.
This is great. Okay, now what about the Muscadet?
Yeah, Muscadet gets no credit at all. Maybe 50 years ago, it was respected as the poor man's Chablis. And then maybe after the end of World War II, people drank it in all sorts of bistros and little restaurants around Paris. And if you were lucky enough to go to Europe in the 50s or the early 60s and you happen onto a little cafe in Paris, you'd be drinking Muscadet with your oysters.
Mm-hmm.
And then it completely fell off the radar screen, and it's just beginning to come back now. It's at the mouth of the Loire River, which if you've ever traveled to France, you know is an incredible part of France. It's filled with chateaux and beautiful, lush gardens, and it's a great place to drive around. But Muscadet, being right at the edge of the river near Nantes, never seems to get the tourist traffic that would make it more famous.
Mm-hmm.
But it's made from a grape called Melon de Bourgogne, the melon of Burgundy, which happens not to be grown anywhere near Burgundy. And
it's like the Entre du Mer. It's a great selling tool.
What's up with these French? Why can't they just get it right?
Well, what does it taste like?
It tastes really steely and light and crisp and clean. In fact, it's a grape that's not known for having a lot of flavor, this Melon de Bourgogne. So they do a trick there.
Yeah.
They say, you stay in the vat for a little bit longer than normal, and we're going to let you come in contact with the dead yeast cells that were used to ferment the grape juice into wine. And these dead yeast cells, as they break down, they release a little bit of flavor and then a little more flavor, and eventually they sort of co-mingle with the wine, and it tastes not unlike a champagne. Champagnes get their flavor in large part from the reaction with the yeast cells that are inside the bottle. Here, it's almost like a champagne without bubbles, and it's just incredible. They got it right with the oysters back in the 50s. It's wonderful with shellfish.
Keep the dead yeast. Hey, Josh, thank you.
Yeah, there's today's motto.
Well, Joshua Wesson is president of Bestsellers Wine Shops. You can find his French white wine picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a top chef's private tour of Seattle's Pike Place Market, Calvin Trillin's take on eating in Japan, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here on The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. When I travel, usually the first place I hit in a new town is the farmer's market. It's a great way to read a new place. You get to meet local people, and you get a feel for what the regional specialties are. But there are markets that are actually worth planning a trip around. And at the top of that list is the monarch of markets, the Pike Place Market in Seattle. And we've got the perfect guide. Chef Tom Douglas has built a restaurant kingdom in Seattle, and he's been shopping the Pike Place Market for over two decades. Tom's new book is Tom Douglas's Seattle Kitchen, and it's a love letter to the city. Tom, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Tom, tell me about the Pike Place Market.
Well, it's not like any other market that I can think of. You know, you can go to the Fulton Street Fish Market in New York and buy fish, but when you go to the Seattle Public Market, you're going to the heart and soul of Seattle. It's a neighborhood. It's got everything you can imagine, from a senior center to a child care center to low-income housing, high-income housing. It's got restaurants with views of Elliott Bay. It is our neighborhood. It's where we gravitate towards for special events and for when you really want to show somebody the city, you start at the Pike Place Market. And, you know, there's a hotel in the market called the Inn at the Market. And if you stay there overnight and you get up with the market in the morning, I think it's the best way to experience it. And you just kind of get out about 7 o'clock in the morning. You know, this is America. We don't get up like the Italians do. We get kind of a little bit later start here in Seattle. So 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, things start to come alive. And you get out and you pound the cobblestones and you walk through Post Alley. You kind of wake up with the market, and that's my very favorite thing to do. If it happens to be sunny, great. If not, stick it out. Get a little drizzle in your hair and stop for a cup of coffee. I mean, there's a million places, and just watch it come alive with farmers on organic Wednesdays and Sundays. There's just, you can't imagine the variety of produce year-round that's still coming in. You know, Seattle's a very temperate place.
Yeah, and the market is huge.
It's about three square blocks, which has about 300 places to eat in those three square blocks.
Okay, let's say, for instance, I've got just a couple of hours. What are some of the not-to-miss spots in the market?
Well, first I would go down and get my latte. There's a place called Le Panier, and I would have a latte there with a couple of their little French pastries, a frion, a little sponge cookie is where I would start. And then I would just kind of head out on the street and watch the, you know, there's the Laotian farmers that show up. There's a whole section of the market now that's devoted to flowers. And they all make their bouquets first thing in the morning. And they sell them for, you know, between $5 and $10 for these monstrous bouquets of flowers. And so it's great fun to watch them. They're busy beavers, you know, just putting all different, maybe 10, 12, 13 different kinds of flowers together to make these beautiful bouquets. And then you go down and they're stacking, you know, 400 Dungeness crabs up in a line, you know, caked with crushed ice, and they're laying out their fish, you know, really lovingly packing the bellies with ice and making sure that everything stays cold all day. And then the last thing they bring out are big tubs of, you know, whatever's live at the moment, whether it's crayfish or langoustines or lobsters or mussels. And they set these big tubs of live things on top of everything else that's displayed. And I go over and I say hi to Donnie in the morning at Don and Joe's Meats, and he has just the biggest grin on the planet, and it's a great spot.
I remember this great place, I think it's called the Creamery, that had, just tell us about that, because what's there is just incredible.
It's there. If you're up for a yogurt in the morning, it's the best place to go. They've got the whole cream yogurt from France. But it's Nancy Nipples is her name. She legally had her name changed to Nancy Nipples.
You're joking.
And, no, I'm serious. And she's got a big cow as her logo, obviously, with the big, what do you call those? Are those nipples hanging off the bottom of
teats,
a cow?
Or teats.
Teats. Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so you can go there and you can get goose egg, duck egg, quail egg, 10 different kinds of chicken eggs, all the whole fat buttermilk creams and yogurts, tofus, anything, soy milks, all that kind of product there. That it's so fun. And it's been there since I've been going. I've been buying from her for 24 years now. So
let's talk about, what are some of your favorite places to get things like, you know, maybe spices or dried fruits?
Dried fruits, oftentimes, De Laurentiis in the past has been the place to go. It's an Italian market, but does have certain things like Australian candied fruits and the local dried apples and dried cherries. And, you know, we have a great chucker cherries here in Washington.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's
has
right.
Has great dried blueberries and huckleberries and strawberries and raspberries. I go to Pike & Western Wine Shop, has the best Northwest wine selection going. Even the small producers that you never see outside of the state of Washington are in there, and oftentimes year-round because he keeps them in his cellar. I go to the Market Spice Company, which has every spice you can imagine in bulk, including all the oils, you know, the mint oils and the cinnamon oils and things like that that you might want to have for a special recipe, especially around the holidays.
This is all stuff that's easy to take home, too. I mean, for those of us who are traveling and, you know, don't necessarily have refrigeration available to us.
Absolutely. Easily packed. Everyone's got the big, you know, two-day carriers. All the fish shops have it. There's a, you know what, we have this cool thing. You wouldn't think about it in Seattle, but there's a place called Bavarian Meats. And from my trip to Munich, I always loved getting the big pig knuckles and stuff that are on the rotisseries in Munich and all the smoked hams and stuff. And this place has as good or better than any meats, German style, that I've ever had.
Really?
Great blood sausage, great Landjäger, just dried farmer sausage, and beautiful Kassler whole smoked pork loin roast with the bone on.
Mm.
The best pork ribs you ever want to eat with some sauerkraut or right off the back of that pork loin.
Tom, if you could guide us through the market, it would be nirvana. Second best thing is we'll do it on our own. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Tom Douglas is chef owner of Dahlia Lounge and other restaurants in Seattle. His new award-winning book is Tom Douglas's Seattle Kitchen. Tom wanted us to pass on his recipe for sake steamed sockeye salmon with sake butter. I dare you to say that one fast. But look, salmon season's just about to start, and this one is so easy, and it's so good. You can get the recipe by going to our website, splendidtable.org. Journalist Calvin Trilling practically created his own brand of food writing. You get the feeling when you read his work that Trillin lives in a parallel universe. He sees the same things we do, but his take is, well, it's all his own. Calvin has some advice for those traveling to Japan.
All in all, I spend a lot of time. Time other people might spend worrying about their tax situation or the bomb. Worrying about the possibility that I might go right through a meal somewhere and still miss the good stuff. That's what worried me about going to Tokyo. Talk about the mysteries of the East. Even in European countries that are thoughtful enough to conduct their business in the Roman alphabet, I often get edgy during meals because of a suspicion that the regulars are enjoying some local specialty that the management has hidden from travelers by listing it on the menu in a foreign language. Once, while Alice and I were eating lunch in a Sicilian city called Piazza Armerina, I became nearly frantic at not being able to figure out what was meant by the special of the day listed as Bocca di Lupo, a dish my high school Latin led me to believe was called Mouth of the Wolf. Before placing an order, I thought it prudent to confirm my assumption that the phrase was not meant literally. But no such dish was listed in the dictionary of menu terms that I keep with me at all times in a foreign country, the way some travelers always carry their passport and a carefully hidden American $50 bill. The waiter spoke no English, and he just looked puzzled when I, having quickly exhausted my Italian, cleared my throat and did what seemed to me a passable wolf imitation. We never did order the special of the day, and I have assumed ever since that it is only a matter of time before we run into some old Sicilian hand who says, "I hope you got to Piazza Armerina for some of that marvelous Bocca di Lupo." I was thinking of Bocca di Lupo as Alice and I flew over the Pacific on the way to our first stay in Tokyo. I settled down to my airplane reading, a book that displayed colored pictures of Japanese dishes and explained what they were. As you know, the word for noodles is udon, I announced right away. I always take the precaution of checking the word for noodles before entering any country, just in case. Unless you want the polite form, I went on, which is o udon. That's what I mean about mystery. Why would anyone want to be anything but polite about noodles? My precaution turned out to be well taken. O udon, I was able to shout politely during a stroll on our very first morning in Tokyo, as I stopped Alice in her tracks and pointed to a store window beyond which someone was rolling out noodle dough. By then, I was already feeling much less concerned about the possibility that the language barrier could lead to my starvation. Having arrived in Tokyo the previous evening, tired from the flight, we had gone no farther for dinner than the hotel's sushi restaurant, where it became apparent that someone sitting at a sushi bar, rather than a table, can get his fill simply by pointing at the fish on display. Sitting at the bar is the best place to eat sushi anyway, since a good sushi chef puts on a good show, responding to any order with an almost military aye, a couple of taps with his knife to get the rhythm, some quick strokes at the raw fish, an abrupt jab to plant the fish in a ball of rice, and a flick of the wrist as he places the finished product on the bar in front of you. By the time we stood in front of the store window admiring the technique of the noodle maker, it had also become apparent that we had another great demystification device at our disposal, the Japanese custom of restaurants displaying in their windows full-size, absolutely realistic models of whatever dishes they're offering. We had spent the morning wandering around Asakusa, and a lot of what we had paused to admire had been models of sushi and sashimi and tempura and noodles and lightly fried fish, my idea of window shopping. When we reached the noodle shop, I realized that I was famished. One of the models it displayed looked particularly tempting, a large bowlful of soup with thick white noodles and two huge mushrooms and a bean curd cake. We marched into the restaurant, a small, immaculate place, and I beckoned the proprietor to come with me. We studied the window together. In a moment, he gave a quick nod. We went back inside, and a waitress brought to the table a precise replica of the replica. It was delicious. My confidence continued to grow. At a sushi bar near the central fish market, I realized that I did not have to remain silent when I pointed to a delectable-looking piece of tuna. I could point and say anything I wanted to. Tippecanoe and Tyler too. Or, où se trouve la plage? The results were the same. Aye, the sushi chef would bark and tap his knife a couple of times on the cutting board in anticipation. One evening we wandered into a restaurant whose specialty seemed to be a fish stew that was cooked at the table. Some of the fish in the pot looked very mysterious. Alice picked up a roundish lump with a black appendage on it and peered at it suspiciously. A pure ingredient, I said helpfully. She tried the black appendage. Shrewd of you to bite off the toe before you start on the body, I said. Alice picked carefully at the remainder of the beast. It's not bad, she said, although I wish I knew what it was. Well, this is strictly a fish restaurant, I said. Otherwise, I might conclude that we'd found, at long last, Mouth of the Wolf.
You knock back the schnapps, you talk back to cops, you walk in the room and conversation stops. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere. You stagger, you sag, you're half in the bag. One glass of beer and you're a total drag. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere.
Kelvin Trillin writes for Time Magazine and The Nation. For those fans of Trillin's food writing, you'll be happy to know the entirety of the Tummy Trilogy is available on audio tape.
Call me, tell me, and I'll be around. You
The lines are officially open for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We have Alice on the line. So, Alice, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a wonderful recipe, pasta with mascarpone cheese and minced prosciutto.
What could be bad? This is beautiful.
And it's a wonderful dish, but it uses exactly half of a package of mascarpone cheese. And if the cheese is so good, I could eat it with a spoon, but I probably shouldn't. And I never know what to do with the other half of the package.
Oh, dear. Oh, we can make a lot. Well, one of it is you just keep, you know, going into the refrigerator and dipping your finger into it.
To avoid that.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Mascarpone is this fabulous, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's a cheese that comes from northern Italy. In fact, it, I think, originally came from the area near Milan. And it is something like 70% butterfat. It's as though cream cheese became the sexiest thing you can imagine. And it's silky. It melts on your tongue. It's sort of a cross between really dense whipped cream and cream cheese, right?
Right.
And it's technically, it's a fresh cheese. Now, it comes in two forms. One is kind of almost like a brick, and the other one is more like very, very thick sour cream. Which one do you usually
use?
I use
the latter, the thick
sour
sauce.
Cream. Oh, gosh, this is so good. I'll tell you what the Italians do, okay? You get any kind of good seasonal fruit or berries. And I think in another while you're going to see good strawberries. You could even use frozen raspberries for this. You take the mascarpone and you mix it with vanilla and sugar to taste. And you layer it in a parfait. You put the fruit, you put the mascarpone, you put the fruit, you put the mascarpone. And then if you want, you finish it off with a little, you know, sort of a thin slicing of candied orange rind. And it's fabulous. And it's like eating ice cream. And you don't need a lot of it. You know, as you know, it's really rich. Now, the other thing you can use it for is if you make frozen desserts that call for whipped cream, you can thin the mascarpone very slightly with heavy cream and use that instead.
Oh.
Now, we make, it's a recipe from my book, The Splendid Table. It's an espresso mascarpone frozen dessert. It's called a semifreddo in Italian. It's like a mousse. And what you do is you just cook eggs and strong, strong espresso coffee together until it's 180 degrees with sugar to taste and vanilla. And you let that cool, and then you fold in the mascarpone and you fold in some Italian meringue. It's all in the recipe, but the idea is it's egg whites that you've cooked with sugar syrup so they're safe to eat. It's whipped cream, rather, it's mascarpone and it's espresso coffee.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Oh, it's killer. It's killer.
Well, then do we die after we eat the pasta and the mascarpone?
Well, I wouldn't do this at the same meal. I think the rule with mascarpone is it appears once in
right.
dinner, because if you do it more than once, people are going to be under the table. They roll around and they groan a lot.
Oh, but how wonderful the next day. That's perfect. Now I don't have to waste it.
That's right. That's right. You really don't. And it's such good. Think ice cream. Think the richest vanilla ice cream or very rich whipped cream, and then use it accordingly.
Okay.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, let's take a break from calls for our weekly trivia challenge. Here's today's trivia question. How do the holes get into Swiss cheese? Is it specially hired worms, little Swiss gnomies, or what? Again, the question is, what's the secret behind the holes in Swiss cheese? We're going to have that answer in a minute and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We've got open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. The number's 800-537-5252, and we will talk. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what's the secret behind the holes in Swiss cheese? Well, it's a little bacteria that does big things, and it's tricky to pronounce. It's called Propionibacter schermanti. As the cheese ripens, evidently this bacteria eats up the lactic acid that's given off by other bacteria. Now, what this bacteria throws off is carbon dioxide. It collects in big pockets, and that's how you get the holes in the cheese. Evidently, in cheese making, it's all about the survival of the fittest. The bacteria with the most staying power wins. With Swiss cheese, Propionibacter schermanti makes the biggest splash. It dictates how the cheese looks, and it influences how it tastes. Now, prime Swiss cheese has to come from Switzerland. Forget all this imitation stuff. And in Switzerland, it's called Emmental. When it's great, it tastes nutty. It almost tastes like you're eating fruit. And then after you swallow it, you get this little bite. Very pleasing. Now, one of the ways you know you're getting the real thing is the word Switzerland has to be stamped on the cheese. It's printed in red. By the way, this is a raw milk cheese, and the Swiss are famous for their sanitary standards, so it's perfectly safe. Always buy it in chunks. Don't buy it pre-sliced. Okay? The best way I know, by the way, of enjoying Emmentaler, aside from with the best ham you can lay your hands on some good whole grain bread, is to eat it with dried fruit. Try little bits of the cheese with some dried pear or dried apricot. Okay, let's get back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's been waiting patiently. We've got Patrick on the line. So, Patrick, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lynn, how are you doing?
I'm doing swell.
I've got a minimalistic cooking question for
you. A minimalistic cooking question?
Yes.
You may be talking to the wrong woman. I am the most Baroque cook you will ever meet.
Well, this will be a challenge for you. Then.
All right, okay.
At the end of this month, I'm graduating, and to celebrate, a couple of my friends and I are going backpacking for a week in May.
This is a celebration?
Yes.
A celebration is going to the Stanford Court with room service. A celebration is staying at one of the great hotels in the entire country and laying on a chaise lounge and having someone peel you a grape. You're going hiking?
You sure own, I guess. Yeah, I absolutely love it.
All right, Patrick. So, okay, I can't argue this you out of this one. All right. Obviously, you're very athletic, and I admire this. But where does the minimalism come in?
Well, what I was hoping for to get some help on was we were planning our menu for the week. We're going to be camping for 7 days.
Right.
And the most challenging meal by far is the last meal of the week. We've been hiking for 7 days. We've had to carry everything on our back the entire time.
Mm.
We're going to be pretty hungry, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions of what we could do. Now, of course, there's going to be some stipulations. We're only going to have one stove, one burner.
Right.
Two pots.
Mm-hmm.
And we really can't cook anything for too long because we don't have a ton of fuel with us.
I understand. And you're not going to build a fire, are you?
No fire. We're doing this low impact of the wilderness.
I see. Yeah.
And
hey, but you're missing out on all that wood smoke. I mean, all right. I know, it's minimalist. See, more is more, Patrick. More is more. Okay, so you're saying you need to know, and you don't want, I mean, you've got all the dehydrated, dried stuff out there.
Right, and we can get the prepackaged things, but I love to cook.
You love to cook.
And I figure, why not try to combine the two of my passions and see if I could come up with something fun for my last meal?
You know what I'm almost tempted to suggest? I can't help it. Italy keeps coming to mind. Now, they have mountains. Very high mountains.
Okay.
Do you know what Italian mountain climbers carry with them because it gives them very fast protein energy?
No idea.
Prosciutto di Parma.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, the deal here is interesting. It's one of the great sources of protein that you easily absorb because the whole curing process, which takes a year. And by the way, it's just ham and salt. I mean, there's no chemicals in it at all. that process actually breaks down some of the protein so that you can easily digest it. You get the energy very quickly, and it tastes wonderful. And a very little bit goes a long way. But what I'm thinking is, if how many of you are there going to be?
There's going to be three of us.
If you had a half a pound of thin sliced prosciutto, and are you going to be in a cool place?
They've said there could be snow, so it's going to be cooler.
Oh, it's going to be cool. Okay, yeah. So the ham can last at room temperature. You see, so obviously, and you're going to be in a cool place. I think you'd be safe. You know what would be marvelous to do? Would you be up for the idea of cooking pasta or some other grain?
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah.
And then seasoning it with prosciutto?
Mm.
And maybe some herbs, even dry herbs could be delicious. And either, I'm trying to think of some kind of fat that would be luscious. I mean, butter is tempting, but I can imagine what it's going to look like after a week of camping. but you know, maybe olive oil, gosh, I know it can spill and you might have a problem. I'm just thinking how luscious it would be to sit down to even a bowl of wheat berries that you've boiled or pasta that you've cooked with that chopped up prosciutto tossed into it at the last minute, maybe with some Parmigiano Reggiano cheese. Again, 8 ounces of it.
Okay.
Shaved. You don't have to grate it. You don't have to have a grater. You just need a peeler of some kind or a knife. Just shave it.
Okay.
And toss that with the hot pasta. It will just feel so good. I mean, it will feel wonderful.
That sounds fantastic.
I could suggest, other than the dried stuff, I mean, you want very concentrated nourishment in what you're doing.
Right.
And that's where those dried fruits and that kind of thing come in. But also think about the cured meats, but the very good ones, the ones that aren't packed with chemicals, like prosciutto.
Oh, and can you pick those up at most delis? Or
I think a good ethnic market should have a good prosciutto di Padma.
Okay.
And worst comes to worst, I mean, if you can plan ahead and you want to really treat yourself, there is a dynamite website. There's a couple of them that can mail them to you. One is called Esperia, Esperya. Incredible quality Italian food.
Okay.
Dynamite quality. Can't say enough good things about it. And the other one is chefshop, oneword.com.
Okay.
And they can mail you some, and Zingerman's. Zingerman's is the third one.
I'm actually down the street from Zingerman's.
You are? Well, my God, you're down the street from Nirvana. Okay. And then after this, we'll talk about getting you to a really great hotel.
Okay. Recuperate for the trip.
Yeah, check in and tell us how it all worked out. And by the way, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Goodbye. I think he's nuts. Oh, well, okay. Well, by the way, we have another online chat coming up on Monday, May 14th. This time we're going to talk about all things restaurant. You can get details on our website. That's splendidtable.org. Okay, let's get back to the landlines. We've got Nancy on the phone. So, Nancy, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Potatoes, and yeah, particularly that they market them to us in 5 and 10 pound bags. And it's quite the challenge to get through the bag before they start sprouting or turning green.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've read various things as to whether the green will kill you or not. and just the challenge of how do you use potatoes up in an enjoyable fashion in that large quantity?
Well, first of all, there's nowhere where you can shop where you can buy them, kind of, you know,
yeah,
by the
but
pound.
They charge, you know, comparatively,
you're
better off throwing out half of the bag than buying them by the pound.
Yeah, you're right. Okay.
So they kind of induce you. I've come up with a few things, but it seems like I still end up with some either sprouting or kind of shriveled.
And you're wondering, can you use those?
Well, I'm wondering, especially the ones that have a green tint to it.
It comes down to this, okay? If it's green and it's a potato, cut off all the green because, believe it or not, it can kill you.
Right. Okay. Because is cutting it off good enough?
Yeah. If there's absolutely no sign of green when you get done trimming it, you're okay.
Okay.
Because the green is develops on the potato when it's exposed to light or situations where it's too cold or too warm.
Okay.
And it is a form of a poison. And you, and evidently it can, you know, eat enough of it and you can die. And also it doesn't taste good. And evidently when it sprouts, the sprouts also have a lot of that toxic substance.
Ah.
So you cut them out. Now, if you end up with just white potato after you do that, that potato is safe.
Okay.
There's a couple of things you can do. Now, one of the things with potatoes is they're hard to freeze because, you know, they get watery and they break down and their flavor changes. But if you have them mixed with other things, they can freeze pretty well. Now, I do a potato gratin that has so much cream in it, so much garlic, and so much cheese that when I freeze it, it throws off some liquid, but it still tastes great when I reheat it.
That's a neat idea.
Yeah, and what I do is, it's extremely rich, but boy, it's out of this world. You thin slice the potatoes, and you then chop up a ton of garlic, and you butter a pan really generously. You put a layer of potatoes. You put some boiled cream. You can simmer the cream for about 10 minutes to thicken it. Mm-hmm. And you put in the cream. You put in a lot of garlic, salt, and pepper, and then you just keep layering. And you put some cheese between the layers. And you can bake that and then freeze it. And you can freeze it in small portions, and then you can microwave it or heat it up. The other thing is, look up potato puddings, because they usually hold up really well, and they're delicious.
Okay, because I started to make potato kugel.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't think to freeze it, but you're saying that I probably could
get
away
in some cases,
that.
When there's a lot of other ingredients, yes, you can, and especially if there's anything with flour.
It's mostly egg, potato, onions.
It may not freeze all that well. Yeah,
okay.
It may not freeze all that well, but it's a great dish. The other thing is you can make potato soups, smooth potato soups that you cook the potatoes with lots of vegetables and you puree half of it and the other half you leave plain. So you have chunks and you freeze that and that holds up really well.
Okay.
Okay.
Wonderful. Thank you for your input. Appreciate
you are
that.
Welcome. You are welcome. Enjoy the potatoes.
Either that or I'll have to start juggling with them.
Yeah, you can do that. You can entertain. Go
right.
On a street corner. You'll make money.
Wonderful. Thank
okay.
you much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You know, you probably could have made a million if you were a salad eater with a crystal ball, say, about 10 years ago. If you'd invested in packaged salad greens back then, you'd be set for life today. Who knew that those packaged salad mixes would take off the way they have? But I want to know what's actually in those bags. I mean, how can they stay fresh? So to get some answers, we have one of the pioneers in packaged organic salads on the phone. He's Drew Goodman from Earthbound Farms. Drew, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
So, Drew, where did you get the idea to put the salad in the bag?
Well, we were doing that in our own home. We had a small garden, and we were supplying some top restaurants in our area with raspberries, herbs, and salad greens. And really, that was what we were doing for ourselves. There were long days in the summer where we were working till 8 o'clock, and we'd want to come home and have a salad and have our dinner. So we would harvest a whole box full of greens and wash them up and put them in bags for our own use throughout the week. And then when we realized how well it was working for us, we thought it had potential to be a product. And lo and behold, you can't go into a grocery store in this country without seeing bagged salads on the shelf.
I would love to have your bank account, to be quite blunt, but anyway, no, but it's a brilliant idea. But what is actually in that bag? I mean, do you put gas in it to keep them fresh, or I mean, how does this work?
Well, our salads, I think there was a, we were fortunate, there was a bit of good luck, because at the time we had a 2-acre garden, really, and not very much technology like we do today to package salads in a refrigerated environment and do all the things we do today. But our big advantage was we were using the baby lettuce leaves that we were growing, which actually really lend themselves very well to being packaged with a good shelf life, because it's not really a chopped product like a lot of the other conventional packaged salads you see on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
So we were harvesting these whole leaves, and they just had inherently a good shelf life. We have now expanded into chopped organic romaine and iceberg salads, and those salads you do inject nitrogen in the bag, mm-hmm. which helps helps extend the shelf life by keeping the lettuce from browning where it's been chopped.
It says on the package usually that it's pre-washed, but you want us to wash it again?
We suggest that people do whatever they're most comfortable with doing. I mean, our company is very committed to producing a safe pre-washed product that can be eaten out of the bag, and that's how we consume it. But people have, you know, varying degrees of comfort. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd say, knowing our process, it's washed three times, it's packaged in a refrigerated, sanitary environment, and I have no problem eating it out of the bag or serving my kids the salad out of the bag. But people need to do whatever they're most comfortable doing.
Well, Drew, thank you.
Sure. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Drew Goodman from Earthbound Farms Packaged Salads. Well, everybody, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with a bit of political incorrectness from Calvin Trillin. He said, and I quote, "I'm in favor of liberalized immigration because of the effect it would have on restaurants. I'd let in everybody except the British." The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, offering Cascade stoneware made by Anchor Hocking. This Portuguese stoneware, designed to be rugged, features an unglazed bottom for even cooking and can be used in the microwave, oven, or on the table. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music was composed by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.